All right, this is Steli FD.
And this is Heaton Shaw.
And in today's episode of The Startup Chat, we're going to do a rapid-fire Q&A.
I think we like talking about more than just sales and marketing.
We just want to bullshit and chat about business and life, and hopefully while we're doing that, provide a lot of value to people.
The world's best business podcast.
Oh, shit. We got it.
For people trying to get shit done.
Yeah. We don't want to give you feedback that's bullshit.
Yeah, we want you to do your best.
So you guys submitted a ton of questions when we did the live event. We did a live recording of the Startup Chat here in Palo Alto. It was a blast, a ton of fun. And we got a ton of people to submit more questions online. And we honestly never gotten to answer those questions. We just got occupied with the live audience. So we thought, let's do a follow-up episode and just rapid fire go through the questions that people asked us and see if we have answers for them. Sounds good?
Yep. And we're just going to alternate, right? So, yes. And you have the list, so I'll let you say that.
I'm going to ask all the questions, but you're going to be answering one. I'm going to be answering one.
Perfect.
All right, let's rock and roll. So the top rated question here that we had was, do you guys have any hidden agenda in doing the podcast we don't know about? Question for you, Heaton.
For me? Oh, yeah. No, we have no hidden agenda. We are two founders and entrepreneurs who like helping other people that also equally like or more like talking to each other about these topics. So we're just doing this for the love of it. And you'll see us struggle through doing experiments on Facebook groups or live chats and all that. We even have what Steli and I call a roadshow where we go on, if we're at the conference together or something like that, we'll do a Q&A on stage and stuff. We're having fun with it. And we keep getting feedback that this is valuable, so we keep doing it. But there is absolutely no specific hidden agenda. What you see is what you get. What you hear is what you get.
Exactly. All right, let's go to the next question. When have you been most wrong and why? For example, absolutely sure about something, your pitch, your product, some outcome, and the exact opposite occurred. That's a good question. I've been wrong about so many things. I don't know what the most wrong was.
You want to just spitball a few things you were wrong about? Yeah, that might help. Because I can do the same. I don't even know what they are yet, but go ahead.
So I was definitely very wrong about my idea on what it would take to be successful, which was, in my mind, suffering and pain and 20-hour workdays, 7 days a week for years and years and years. I just thought the more hours I accumulate and the more pain I pay as a currency, the more successful I get. And I do think it takes hard work, it takes hours, it takes pain, but I don't think that's the only currency you have to pay. And I was more busy with long days of being in front of a computer versus like how productive I really was. So that was definitely something I was really wrong about. I could keep going on for hours, but let's just keep it at that so we keep rock and rolling. My idea of entrepreneurship was you eat really unhealthy, you sleep very little, you work insane hours, and you suffer in pain all the way up until success. And I don't think that that's necessarily the only way to do it or even the best way to do it. All right, next question. You talk about kids and parents, but what about spouses? How did your startup life affected them in a good or bad way?
Wow. Okay.
Wow, yeah.
We might do an episode on this.
Yes.
So I'm just going to say my story really quickly. So my story is basically I'm married to my co-founder's sister. I met her first and she introduced me to her brother, who I've started every one of my tech companies with and will continue to do so. So my relationship with my wife, it's almost like what I like to say about it is she knew what she was getting into and I knew what I was. She manages all our finances and money, and I work with her brother to make the family as a collective more money. And that's kind of how we divide a lot of things up. But that also means, that also means that, there's just a ton of, for lack of a better word, compromise that we figured out over the years of things we both are responsible for. I would say that episode and that analogy of Batman and Robin is very much how I treat my relationship with my wife as well.
It's a beautiful thing. It's very different for me. This is definitely an episode-worthy question. So my spouse has nothing to do with entrepreneurship. She's not involved in any of my businesses. Right now, she's completely kind of focused on our children, so she's not working. And I think are there some positive ways that me being an entrepreneur has affected her? For sure. But the negatives, or one negative that I can definitely see, is that it is hard to be, I think, in a relationship with somebody that gets a lot of attention and a lot of limelight and is doing something that seems very prestigious when you are doing something that's equally challenging and much more valuable, which is taking care of the children, but maybe you don't feel that that's as significant or as valued in society. And it's sometimes, I think, tough for my spouse to be with me just because of the amount of attention and praise and whatever outwardly rewards that I get. And my life outside is so different from our life together. And I think that that can be very, very challenging at times. Although there's many benefits that come from it and many beautiful things, I do think also that it's kind of challenging because it's such a strong contrast. All right, let's go with the next one. The next question is, how do you handle building teams that have diverse views but similar values? Sometimes it's tough to tell the difference. Here you can actually see that this person has listened to our episodes in the past because we talked about and it did talk about a lot about how we personally at Closer, we love to bring people together and hire people that have totally different backgrounds but have very similar values. So it's tough to see the difference. How do you differentiate? That's a really good question. One core value, so maybe this is the hack. One core value that everybody at CloseEye, for instance, shares is that we are interested in people that are different from us because we're interested in learning. We're interested to have people that will open our eyes about certain things we're not, you know, knowledgeable about. So almost every time we have somebody join the team where it turns out to be a very big success culturally, it's somebody that at the beginning, lots of people will say, this person is so weird, but they'll say it with a smile on their face. They'll say it with like admiration. You're so weird. You're interested in this really like obscure thing. Tell me more about it. Like that is a positive thing in the culture that we have built in the company versus the, this person is weird. What the fuck? They care about this weird thing. I'm bored. I don't want to hear this. I don't want to talk to this person. So maybe one value that you want to look for if you want to have a team with diverse backgrounds is that you have people that value people with different opinions and different backgrounds and are actually curious and appreciative of that, as in like, I want that in my life. I want to have people around me that are different so I can learn from them versus turned off by it. Oh, this person's interested in something I'm not, so I don't want to talk to them. I don't know if this answers the question, but this is the first that comes to mind in my head. Do you have anything to add here, Heaton? Because this is a tricky one.
I know we have other questions. I love your answer, but it speaks to something very specific to me, which is basically the fact that it's very cultural. Like at our company, like I think at our companies, everyone is very different. But at the same time, I don't think we're identifying that as they join the company. What we're identifying as they join the company is more the alignment around the value. So we're actually looking for sameness, but not necessarily sameness in the outwardly, like do they go skiing or snowboarding or like me, nothing.
Yeah.
Or you know, we don't look for that, but we look more for like the shared values of how to approach things or life or business or this opportunity, things like that.
All right. So let's go to the next one. Silicon Valley is full of wannabe entrepreneurs. How does a person find out if he or she is not a fit for entrepreneurship? And we actually at the Life event had somebody ask the difference between a real entrepreneur and just an entrepreneur. And we had some fun with that question. I think that's an interesting question of like, how do you separate just, how do you identify if you're a wannabe or if you're for real?
That's so funny. the reason I think it's funny is because, you know, I think everyone truly does have the potential to do, you know, be a founder, be an entrepreneur or whatever. I think the wantrepreneur side, the most common thing I see is just lots of, you know, and we've had an episode and we've talked about this before, but like lots of motion. So going to a lot of networking events mm-hmm. and stuff like that, instead of lots of progress towards a goal that they have, which really is like, am I closer to making money on this? Mm-hmm. Am I closer to making a business out of this? Am I closer to getting, you know, high retention on my consumer product? Like, this is what I want to hear someone focused on. So I would identify if they're taking action or not. And if that action is motion, then it's probably not good. And if that action is progress, then yeah, they're on their way.
All right. Good one. Let's take the next one. This is actually beautiful because it fits for me. What's the best sales tactics to sell a new experience to people who are not thinking about it? Like when e-commerce was new, for example. So I'll give you one tactic. There's lots of things to discuss here. But one thing you want to do is you want to figure out if you can relate it to something that was new in the past that has become very common in the present. So one example that I would give is, let's say you have this new marketing platform for Snapchat, right? And now you're talking to small and medium-sized businesses and you're trying to convince them that they should be advertising advertising on Snapchat, this thing they don't understand, they might have barely heard of, and they might be really afraid that it's kind of a waste of time. A way to sell that completely new kind of platform for them and make that appealing is potentially to see if you can relate it back to another time they felt similar and they were wrong. Like, hey, remember when search engines started allowing you to do marketing and the first kind of restaurants or businesses around your area started advertising on Google? Remember the time? Were you one of the first or one of the last? Did that seem also like a fluke, this weird thing, search engines really and advertising on there? Will this really work or not for my local business? Will I get enough traffic from it? Well, some people jumped on that train, and because that platform was massively successful, they got all the ROI of knowledge, experience, skill, and being first on those platforms. Today is the exact same thing. This is very much very, very similar. Today, the early adopters are going to join and they're going to get all the benefits of being first, of learnings, experience, and taking advantage of advertising on this now when it's not so crowded, it's so expensive. So that is just one tactic. Finding a past, and maybe this is a terrible example for your audience, but you try to find when in the past did you do something, was a new technology introduced or some new experience, the way you asked the question, and it became common, it became a standard. And then relaying that today, this new thing could be very similar. In 10 years, this is going to be a standard. And if you join this today, you're going to have the benefit of being early to market. It's just one tactic to throw out there. All right, next question. Is Heaton really that wise in person? Yes. Do you measure ROI on your podcast, or is it true altruism? We don't measure the ROI on the podcast, so it's altruism-ish. Like, I mean, we do, if we didn't feel like it was meaningful and valuable to people, we wouldn't be doing it. But we don't do it because I don't know how many close-eye customers I'm getting from the podcast. No fucking clue. And I don't think you track any of this in terms of, is this generating customers for you?
No, I'll be very honest. I don't even look at the listens and downloads currently. I don't even know how to log in at this exact moment.
Yeah.
And it's because it's important to me that people are listening, of course. But we get enough feedback that we should keep doing this.
Yeah. We get enough like emails, tweets. We meet people in person that we know people are listening, and lots of people seem to get value out of it and really care about it. So, all right.
You know, on that note, if anyone's listening and they're getting value out of this, we only do it because we get the feedback loop that you're getting value. And we also only do it because we like to get better. So if you've got feedback for us on how to make this better, or you know, you've got some, you know, feedback that, hey, this has been really helpful to me, please let us know. Tweet at us. It's HN Shah on Twitter, HNSHAH, or Steli, STELI on Twitter. Steli, sorry to take over for a second, but I just want to make it a point. We haven't really asked for feedback in a while, and I think it's, you know, obviously great to do.
I love it. We need to do a lot more of it. So beautiful. Yeah. All right. So next question for you, Heaton, is what's the best thing a startup should do to survive through boom and bust cycles?
Oh man, focus on your business, focus on revenue and cash. Cash is, if you're venture funded, you probably want to make sure you have a lot of cash. I'm going to give a quick anecdote about this. Some of the smartest SaaS companies have raised so much money without being unicorns that they're going to be okay for 1, 2, 3, 4 years. And this is all publicly available information. Just look at some of the amount of money these companies have raised and do the math on their burn rate. There's no way some of these companies are burning $10 million a month right now. So I think you want to think about your own business the same way if you're self-funded or whatever, which is like during a downturn, there might be some less customers. There might be, all these negative things and things like that. Easy, harder to get money if you're into that or whatever. But at the end of the day, like you have a business and your job is to build a business, period, regardless of, you know, whether it's short term, medium term or long term. And, you know, oftentimes what you see in a downturn is you see a lot less consumer stuff get funded because those things take way longer to start getting, revenues, while a lot more B2B stuff gets funded, a lot more self-funded things start showing up. So, all these things are natural, but the most common element about them is we just have a flee towards hardcore business fundamentals. And just to nail the coffin on this or whatever, everybody I'm seeing right now is showing me their Excel spreadsheets and their models and how they think they're going to do in the next month, 2 months, years, whatever. And it's not lame and it's not MBA bullshit. It's actually business fundamentals coming back. And I, for one, am excited because every downturn, that's what happens.
Awesome. All right. So next question is, what do B2B SaaS companies usually forget to think about if they want to go and grow from 1 million to 5 million in ARR? I think we talked about this in like...
An episode
on like 1,000 customers and beyond, and kind of how to scale at that level. I'll just throw out one little tip. There's millions of things, but one thing is that I think getting to 1 million in ARR, you're very execution heavy on like a day to day, a week by week basis. You're really like violently executing mediocre plans in the here and now. And that's what you need in the early days. But once you get to like 1 million or so, you now have enough scale that you need to start adjusting a little bit culturally in terms of how the company executes to be still fairly short term, but also a little bit more mid and long term focused. So you need to start anticipating what are the things we're going to need in the next 3, 6, 12 months, and how are we going to start setting these things up, investing in employees, investing in different types of marketing, just starting to invest in things that you're going to need in the future and start anticipating what will the next step be and how can we prepare that step? Because you're going to be running out of tactics that got you to 1 million might not get you to 5. So you're going to run out of the things you're doing that are very effective in the early days will run out of effectiveness. And then if you don't